and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C. Tanzania's main opposition leader, Tundu Lissu, plans to lead the effort for constitutional reforms.
What has made it possible for me to return this time is the other steps that President Samia Suluhu Hassan and her government have taken to create the necessary conditions for political dialogue, which will lead to political reforms, necessary political reforms in the country.
The campaign team of candidate Peter Obi says he will win the coming presidential election in Nigeria.
The Nigerians came out in large numbers to give their organic support for Peter Obi. And then at the end of it all, that was generated into what you saw on the 1st of October. And gradually, that now has transformed into critical structure that you see.
And the National Executive Committee of Ghana's main opposition National Democratic Congress announces a reshuffle of its top leadership in Parliament.
We just concluded the national executive election, and so the next thing we needed to do was to have a second look at our leadership in Parliament, and that's just what we have done.
Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Tanzania's main opposition leader, Tundu Lissu, says he plans to lead the effort for constitutional reforms. Lissu, a former president of the Tanganyika Law Society, says his decision to return home follows assurances of safety from President Samia Suluhu Hassan and her government. The opposition leader was welcomed with a rally on Wednesday in the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. His arrival came days after the opposition Chadema held its official rally last weekend. The president had earlier lifted a ban on political rallies imposed by his predecessor, deceased President John Magufuli. Lissu went into exile in Belgium following the last elections, citing insecurity and an assassination attempt by unknown assailants. I reached Lissu in Dar es Salaam to talk to the opposition leader about his decision to return home and what the future holds for him.
It feels absolutely great to be back home together with my beloved countrymen and women. It is awesome to be able to feel and you know, just get the feel of the sounds and the sights and the smells of home. It is absolutely, absolutely awesome.
The big question that most people want to find out is, are you safe? And have you been promised or reassured by the authorities following your meeting with President Samia Suluhu Hassan last year that your safety will be guaranteed?
That's a great question, Mr. Clotty. I have had President Samia Suluhu Hassan's personal assurances when we met in Brussels last February. But over and above that, her government made a public commitment in Parliament. A ministerial statement was given in which the minister responsible for internal security called on us, on all of us who had been forced out of the country, to return home, and he promised that we would be safe. Those two promises are important, but they by themselves they would not have washed with me. What has made it possible for me to return this time is the other steps that President Samia Suluhu Hassan and her government have taken to create the necessary conditions for political dialogue which will lead to political reforms, necessary political reforms in the country. And I'm talking here of the release of over 400 political prisoners, mostly our members, our leaders and members up and down the country who were serving prison sentences on politically related charges. And they've been released in the course of the past 6 months. More importantly and more currently, the president's lifting of the illegal ban on political activity by the opposition parties, which she made the new year on 3rd of January. Now, all these factors combined have created conditions which I believe important for us exiles and for me personally to be able not only to return home safely, but to be able to operate with freedom that is necessary if we are to move forward. Yesterday, after our rally in Dar es Salaam, I was given a police escort home. Now, that may not sound as much, but in a country where the opposition for the past 6 years were treated as dangerous criminals and were being hunted down, and in some cases like my own, you know, there were attempts to kill me. So being given police escort tells you how far we have come since those dark days. And these are very important conditions for us to operate freely and for me to be able to stay in the country without fear of my personal safety.
Now that you are in the country, what is next for you? What is the plan?
The plan and the order of the day is constitutional and political reform. We must strive to create, to give Tanzania a new constitutional dispensation that has been on the cards, that has been part of our debate for the last 30 years. After going through those dark days of the Magufuli regime and the first 1 year or so of President Samia's administration, in which he pretty much tried to follow the footsteps of her predecessor, having gone through all that, it must be clear to everyone, at least it is absolutely clear to us who have victimized during this period, that we must make sure that this dark chapter is not repeated in the future. That means a new constitution, a new democratic constitution for our country. And therefore, for the weeks and months and the years ahead, the biggest focus of my work in Tanzania is to build a national movement which will guarantee us a new constitutional order, a new democratic order.
Tundu Lissu is the main Tanzanian opposition leader. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
Direct from Washington, the voice of America, VOA.
In Nigeria, the campaign team of Peter Obi, presidential candidate of the opposition Labour Party, says it is happy with the rousing welcome at rallies ahead of the coming February 25th presidential contest. Local media reports mammoth crowd at Obi event in several states as his team steps up efforts to converse for votes. They say Obi is generating a lot of buzz among young people who are active on social media. However, analysts caution that many youth do not show up on election day. Opposition groups also say Obi does not have a nationwide party structure, an issue that could make it difficult for him to win. Obi faces stiff competition from the former governor of Lagos State, Asiwa Jubola Ahmed Tinubu, of the ruling All Progressives Congress, or APC, and former Vice President Atiku Abubakar of the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP. For more on the campaign, I reach Yenusa Tanko, the main spokesperson for Peter Obi's campaign.
Most amazingly is the one we got from Kano, because you know Kano is the center of commerce in the northern part, and people believe that probably we will not even get anybody coming out to support us. But there was a mammoth crowd in Sabon Kari, and that shows the organic love Peter Obi have been able to generate since we started this campaign. Remember, they were started accusing us that we are only on the social media. Gradually, we transformed from the social media to physical structure on the ground. The Nigerian we came out in large numbers to give their organic support for Peter Obi. And then at the end of it all, it was that one was graduated into what you saw on the 1st of October. And gradually, that now has transformed into physical structure that you see talking happening in, on the ground, on that particular, in every state, about 40 states of the Federation. So the humongous support is actually youth-based. And that is the major attraction because the youth represent about 51% of the population. And then the women, too, and the aged, too, are giving us full support. So that is very, very encouraging.
Winning Kano and Lagos, effectively a strong position to win the presidency. With the response that you've gotten in Kano, how confident are you that you are going to win the presidential vote, especially with the competition coming from incumbent ruling party candidate Asiwa Jubola Ahmed Tinubu, the former Lagos state governor, and of course the former vice president Atiku Abubakar?
Well, the truth is that there are no president that has been elected as a president of the Federal Republic of Nigeria that has not won either Kano, Rivers, or Lagos. So we are assured by the grace of God that we will win one of them convincingly. And then we will hope that we will have a major winning in all the other two or three states in the land of Lagos and Kano and Lagos. But most importantly, we will have our demography, the youth representation in a large number. Remember, there have been like six polls, and those particular polls have shown that we are in front and leading with 10% different, except for the this day projection, which gave us the belief that we are going to win 15 states. Before, they were saying we cannot win any of the states, but now they said 15 states. We mean that we have the capacity to win even more than 25 or 30, as the case may be. So we continue in our struggle, in our mobilization, in our campaign. As you're speaking to me right now, you're speaking to me while I'm in Gombe State. We just left Katsina State. After Kano, we're in Gombe preparatory. Then from there, we're moving again to Bauchi State. So the campaign trail is moving on and it's getting great acceptance nationwide.
You made mention of the youth of Nigeria, the majority of them, but people say that they are not reliable when it comes to the day of voting. What is going to be different?
For the first time in the history of our country, the Nigerian youth were being accused of being docile. So they came out en masse to register as voters. According to INEC statistics, the registered voters cost about 12.5 million Nigerian youth registered to vote. And they have took out a large number also to go and collect their PVC. That is to show you that this time around is not going to be the same situation as it used to be. It's going to be something different. And that particular difference is that if you have 12.5 million Nigerian youth voting for one candidate, what happened? In 2019, the total number of voters that came in was just at 3 million people. And Buhari won with 15 million. So if you do your mathematics, 12 million out of 15 million, that's when you are left with about 2 million or thereabouts. And that, of course, will close the gap. So we are expecting, on a normal basis of 176,000 polling units, we are expecting per polling unit less than 200 voters, and that will translate almost to about something million. So we are optimistic. This threshold and the numbers is what we are targeting, and we will, by the grace of God, supported by the Nigerian youth, get to that particular level.
What analysts are saying is that you don't have structures. The Obi campaign or the Labour Party does not have the structures in Nigeria to catapult you to victory. How are you dealing with this challenge?
Well, that is why our principal has always said that you and every Nigerian are the structure. Because actually, it is human beings that form a structure. In everywhere you go, you will find an obedient. And I keep on challenging people, and I said, there's an obedient in every family in Nigeria. There's an obedient in every family in Nigeria because they have been affected negatively one way or the other. And so in that particular regard, we have structures everywhere. We have structures everywhere. And the people are the structures. And they have shown it and they're determined to do so for the Nigerian people.
Yunusa Tanko is the main spokesperson for the Peter Obi's campaign. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. The political pressure group Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law is calling on the Central Bank of Nigeria to stick to the deadline of January 31st that will end the circulation of the old notes. This despite opposition from the Senate and House of Representatives. The political pressure group says sticking to the deadline is one way to thwart the effort of politicians who have stockpiled billions of the notes to buy votes in the coming elections. The Senate wants to extend the deadline dates from January 31st to May 31st. Meanwhile, the House of Representatives is threatening to arrest the head of the central bank and other executives if they fail to appear before a committee that's reconsidering the deadline for the withdrawal of the old currency. Deji Adeyanju, the convener of the group Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law, tells me that the central bank gave citizens ample time, 3 months, to exchange their old notes.
Very simple. The CBN must stand strong, must stand firm. A man dies once. Immediately must be ready to die on this issue. Whether he succumbs to the pressure of the politicians or not, if they want to sack him, they will still sack him. So let him even do for the first time in his life by standing his ground and urging members of his team in the Central Bank of Nigeria to stand their ground on this issue. This issue will go a long way to prevent the conventional politicians from stockpiling billions, you know, in warehouses ahead of the election that is just around the corner. Emefiele must also extremely warn bank executives and officials from dishing out or hoarding the new naira notes to go and give to politicians. They must dispense the new naira notes in ATMs. Banks that are not doing this, their license should be seized or they should be suspended from operating for a year or so.
What is the whole idea of this new note? Because people are saying that enough time was not given to citizens across the country to bring in the old naira notes for the new ones.
Citizens were given enough time to bring out their new notes. How much do citizens even have? How much naira do I have in my custody? Citizens have ATM. Nobody has stopped them from using their ATM. Citizens have access of doing online transfer. Nobody has stopped them from doing online transfer. So what's the issue? The only people suffering from this are politicians that stockpile billions of the old naira notes in warehouses. So citizens are not complaining. I have not seen any of my friend or any citizen that has complained about this policy of the CBN. Not even one. I have not seen one person that has complained. So it's a very simple thing.
One senator said that he has not even seen the new note. And so having a sacrosanct deadline will have a disastrous impact on the reason why the notes were put in place in the first place.
I have seen the new naira notes, all the denominations. I have used them. I have gotten many of the notes from the ATM. The senator saying he has not seen it is lying. That is my reply. He's angry because he cannot stockpile the new naira notes for vote buying in his constituency. That is the reason why they are complaining and shouting. Their call on CBN to extend the date is out of place. They do not have such power. The CBN is an independent agency of government. In fact, no arm of the government, whether executive or legislative, can give the CBN directives. Go and read the CBN Act. The CBN is completely independent of all arms of government. The senators, they have no locus. They have no backing in law to issue any directives to the CBN on any issue.
Senator Ndume said that if the CBN did not extend the deadline, the majority of Nigerians will suffer the consequences of that action.
Nigerians are not going to suffer any consequence. Nigerians are not complaining. The people who are complaining are politicians. And thank God you have said it's Ali Ndume. That's why he's angry. And the CBN should not cave in. They should never extend. They should ensure that politicians, you know, will be shortchanged in this their ploy to acquire the new naira notes. And they must extremely warn banks and bank executives who are surrogates of politicians and who do the bidding of politicians that they must not hold the new naira notes. They must stockpile the ATMs. They must make the notes available to customers at the banks, because there are several reports that many bank executives are holding the naira notes and they are taking it to the homes of politicians.
What do you say to Senator Ndume, who moved a motion on the floor of the Senate requesting the CBN to extend the deadline for the exchange of the old notes?
Senator Ndume is simply frustrated by this very smart and brilliant move by the apex bank in the country. Senator Ndume should go and lick his wounds. Those are my words to him.
Deji Adeyanju is the convener of the group Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law. He spoke with me from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, a sociocultural group called Ohenaeze Indigbo is expressing concern over voter apathy ahead of next month's general election. The group says it's worried about the failure of prospective voters to collect their permanent registration cards or PVC, which are required to cast a ballot. The Independent Electoral Commission says thousands of registered voters have not picked up their cards. Alex Ogbonia, the spokesperson for the organization, tells me that a group is teaming up with other organizations to encourage voters to do so.
It's not only the parties. What I'm trying to ginger my people is a wake-up call, and they should realize the need for them to collect the PVC. Because I try to enlighten them that in spite of whatever campaigns and internet social media activism, there's need for them to vote on election day. The major problem in this part of the world is that people place a lot of emphasis on their private enterprise. Sometimes they don't want anything to interfere with their private enterprise, their source of livelihood. Sometimes people have lost confidence in the operational ability of the leaders of the country. Sometimes they think that the votes do not count and things like that. And because of that, they believe that their own private enterprise make more money to them than any other thing that any other hyperbole by the government.
There are also concerns, Dr. Ogbonia, that there's voter apathy in some parts of the country, including the southeastern part of Nigeria. How do you respond to that?
There's a paradox. People have been highly sensitized towards the campaign. The participation in the campaign is so high, the enthusiasm is so high. But the paradox is that there are a lot of uncollected permanent voter cards. How can you express the enthusiasm when you don't have the voter card? So, but coming to it's not apathy at all, because they're willing, they have the enthusiasm. But somehow, it becomes a problem that they have not collected the voter card. That's what I'm saying, that their private enterprise sometimes interferes with their civic responsibilities and duties. So that's what we are trying to urge them, not to allow the private enterprise to interfere with the civic responsibilities and duties as Nigerian citizens.
There seems to be a lot of enthusiasm among the youth of Nigeria, and people are suggesting that some of the youths cannot be trusted to go vote on the day of voting. From what you have seen so far on the ground, are things changing?
Well, from all the rallies, I have often told them that the will of the people will always overwhelm any other incumbency to refer to the election. So the will, the participation, the enthusiasm, they have been high. So I want to believe that they will carry such enthusiasm into the election proper. That is how it is here.
Has there been enough education about people collecting their PVC? Because without the PVC, they cannot vote.
In some states in the South, they have declared public holidays, like in Ebonyi State, in Abia State, public holidays have been declared to enable people to go and collect their PVC. This is a sensitization program to ensure that people collect their PVC. So that's the problem. I've tried to point out to you that by economic determinism, the structure of the economy, the character of the economy, it can mean the political, the social, and the cultural. So we cannot hide the fact of poverty in this country and the need for people to turn up their private enterprise in order to survive first. So I have to choose between survival, self-survival, and civic responsibility or duty. People may be inclined to that self-survival. So that is what is going on now. So but we are urging them to appreciate the need for that civic responsibility, because ultimately, the political power determines the dynamics of any given society.
Some people have called on civic groups to partner with INEC to really encourage people to take their voter cards or PVC cards to go to the polls to vote. How is your group helping with the sensitization efforts to have these young men and women and prospective voters go for their cards?
My SNDP is persuasive. It's a persuasive organization. We have persuaded the governors to ensure we have public holidays, encourage the citizenry to collect their PVC. That's what we have done by the press release I made today. So we are doing everything possible to make sure I leave no stone unturned, so that what we call voter apathy will not occur related to 2023 general election.
Alex Ogboinia is the spokesperson for the social cultural group called Ohanaeze Indigbo. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. VOA.
Stay engaged with VOA Africa. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message, comments, or greetings. Dial the international code +1 then 202-258-3076. The number again is the international code +1 then 202-258-3076.
The National Executive Committee of Ghana's main opposition National Democratic Congress, or NDC, has announced a reshuffle of its top leadership in parliament. The objective of the move, representatives of the party say, is to boost its electoral prospects next year. However, local media reports say some members of parliament from the NDC are not happy with the reshuffle. They have signed a petition calling on the National Executive Committee to rescind the decision. For more on the reshuffle and the latest political development, I reach Johnson Asiedun Ketia. He is the national chairman of the main opposition National Democratic Congress, or NDC.
The reshuffle is in line with our general effort to reorganize the party from the branches to the topmost. So we just concluded the national executive elections. And so the next thing we needed to do was to have a second look at our leadership in parliament, and that's just what we have done.
So far, what has been the reaction? Because I understand about 91 members of parliament have called for that decision to be rescinded.
I know about an effort to list people and then issue statements in their name. Some of them have since called me to dissociate themselves from that move, indicating that they were not aware of what those names that were being compiled were going to be used for. So, but in any case, no such statement has come to me.
Mr. Chairman, why this time? Perhaps last year, that would give the party enough room for this dust to settle in order to prepare for next year's general election?
We were ready to go ahead last year, but there were intervening circumstances that put the move on hold. So much of the consultation was done and the decisions were taken last year. And because of the national elections that were engaged in, it wasn't possible for the national leadership to proceed with such decisions. So we had to put it on hold. And now a new leadership has taken over. So we decided to continue and complete the process. And that is just exactly what we've done.
Does the National Executive Committee repose confidence in the new leadership, especially when some supporters of the NDC have told me personally that the previous leadership did quite well, providing the needed check and balance to the ruling party? So what will you tell some of these supporters who are not necessarily happy about the reshuffle?
Every term generates its own leadership. There were times the effort was just to checkmate the ruling party on every other issue. Now it has become clear that the election 2024 is going to be fought on the area of economy energy and infrastructure. So the battlefield has clearly been delineated. So we cannot go into that election with just any other leadership fighting everything. We have to be strategic in the selection of leaders who, even after criticizing what the government is doing, have the capacity to propose better alternatives so that we position ourselves as an alternative government. And that is what we have done. We've chosen Dr. Atoforsen, who is our lead person in finance and economy, to be the minority leader. So every opportunity he gets in any meeting, any engagement, the economy will feature in. That is what we have done. Then the deputy minority leader is an energy expert. So he will carry the battle on the energy front. And then the chief whip is an expert in infrastructure, an engineer by profession. And so we didn't just go selecting people based on their tribe or religion or anything. We selected people who have the skills for the job at hand. And so the previous leadership did their best in the circumstances that prevailed at that time, when the battleground had not been clearly delineated. Now we have the battleground clearly delineated for 2024, and we got to choose our best soldiers to fight the battle. And that is what we have done. And besides that, we are under obligation in this party to make sure that there is some regional balance in the selection of our leadership across the country. And so the two regions where two of the new leaders come from, Western region is a swing region, Central region is a swing region, and they are very critical to our victory in 2024. And these are two regions that have never featured on the front bench of our side in parliament. And so they are excited and have already started jubilations that at long last the party has recognized their worth and have given them the pride of place. And so all these considerations came to play in the selection of our new leadership. And we are very confident that they are the right team to do the job for the party to come to power in 2024.
Johnson Asiedun Ketia is the national chairman of Ghana's main opposition National Democratic Congress, or NDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has inaugurated the launch of oil drilling in Kikubi district near Lake Albert. Local reports say the Kingfisher oil field is expected to produce about 40,000 barrels of oil per day. The move, officials say, paves the way for the government to achieve its goal of starting full production by 2025. For more on the prospects of the much-anticipated oil production in the East African country, I reach Pauline Irene Batebe via Skype. She is the Permanent Secretary in the Ugandan Ministry of Energy and Mineral Development.
Oh, yes. We've just had the launch of our first drilling at one of our development areas. And for us, that was a momentous moment, because it then gets us to our ambition of producing oil in 2025. And this has been a journey since the 80s until when we discovered commercial reserves in 2006, and we consequently entered a season where we were putting in place the right legal and regulatory framework to support the production. So in terms of how this is going to benefit Uganda as a country, Definitely, we've put all the building blocks in place to ensure that this oil is beneficial to the people of Uganda. We have been very particular to address aspects of participation of Ugandans in the oil and gas industry through what we call national content, or in other places is called local content.
Irene, talking about benefits, what measures, specific measures, is the Ugandan government implementing to ensure the oil directly benefits the people instead of being a curse? Because, you know, there has always been this debate about oil in Africa being a curse or a blessing. So what specific measures is Uganda implementing to ensure that people benefit and it's not a curse to the people of Uganda?
Yes, we have been very careful to look at aspects of revenue management. As working with our Ministry of Finance in Uganda, we have put in place a bespoke law to support how these revenues will be managed. So under our Public Finance and Management Act, we do provide for how the proceeds from the oil and gas industry will be put to use. And we've been very categorical in that act that these revenues will only go to support infrastructure development. And we've already seen that, because remember, throughout the licensing, we were attracting some revenue in terms of signature bonuses and other rental fees. And some of these revenues already, we are investing in some of our hydro projects and ensuring that the oil revenues are put to sustainable utilization in infrastructure development. But also, when it comes to it being a blessing, we have addressed aspects of the environment to ensure that this sector or industry can coexist with the people of Uganda, the communities where we'll be operating.
Talking about the environment, what about when issues come up where the process of production impacts directly on not only on the environment, but the people? How will the enforcement be done to ensure that the laws that they signed up to are enforced without fear or favor?
Yes, and that is part of what I indicated were our foundational blocks. So as part of the process, we ensured we are putting in place a robust institutional framework where we have a regulator, the Petroleum Authority of Uganda, that is tasked with regulating the industry and ensuring high compliance standards in the industry. So these companies will be required to adhere to the approval that was given at the time they were issued their certificate for the environmental social impact assessment. And the regulator on a daily basis has representatives in the fields regulating the day-to-day operations to ensure that these mitigation measures, as were approved, are being implemented. So we are really on course.
Talk to me about the steps being undertaken currently to ensure transparency and accountability throughout this process?
Yes, so the very first one, we do have our National Oil and Gas Policy of 2008 that we are currently reviewing to ensure we are addressing emerging issues on the energy transition. But one of our key pillars in that National Oil and Gas Policy is stakeholder management and participation in the industry. So we are a very committed stakeholder management group. We ensure we are engaging our stakeholders on an ongoing basis, be it the civil society organizations. We hold many engagements where we walk through our plans, walk through our challenges, and together with them, we receive feedback and we are able to address that. So stakeholder management, we are big on that. But when it comes to even at global level, we have gone ahead to sign up. We now joined the Extractives Industry Transparency Initiative, the EITI, and they've already done their initial assessment of our oil and gas industry and the wider extractives industry. And we did perform well when it comes to aspects of transparency and accountability. But also when it comes to the revenue, like I indicated, we've been very deliberate on how we are going to handle the revenues. And those are appropriated through the Parliament of Uganda. So the petroleum fund that we've put in place, no one can draw money without the requisite processes and approvals right up to the Parliament of Uganda. So we are as transparent as we can be. And so far, I think we have a track record when it comes to transparency, but also good governance for our extractives industry.
Irene Batebe is the permanent secretary in the Ugandan Ministry of Energy and Mineral Development. She spoke with me via Skype from the capital, Kampala. More than 300 Muslim clerics meeting this week in Somalia's capital have declared their support for the government's war against the Islamic militant group Al-Shabaab. The clerics issued their declaration following a four-day conference of Muslim scholars that ended Thursday with the formation of a Supreme Council. It was the first time in years that Somali clerics from all sects of Islam came together to denounce terrorism, including the conservative Wahhabi sect, who have been accused of sympathizing with Al-Shabaab. VOA Ahmed Mohammed reports from the Somali capital, Mogadishu.
The coming together of the Somali clerics from different ideological persuasions is one of the Somali government's most ambitious attempts to bull religious leaders into the war against terrorism. The meeting is part of the government's triple offensive against Al-Shabaab, which includes military and financial operations in addition to countering extremist propaganda. When Prime Minister Hamza Barre closed the conference, he said it will be instrumental in winning the war against Al-Shabaab and other extremist elements. He said it is the first time he has seen different sects of clerics sitting together and issuing a statement together, so he appreciates that move. And he said they are fighting an enemy whom the clerics have called Khawarij, and he's happy they have joined the fight. Sheikh Awais Abdi, who participated in the conference, called for an uprising against Al-Shabaab. He said those they kill and target with explosions and term as infidels are all Muslims. Therefore, they should be fought. Any soldier who kills Al-Shabaab or is being killed by the Shabaab is a martyr. The Somali government has been waging a military campaign against Al-Shabaab since July last year. In central regions, the government forces working with clan militias have captured a series of towns and villages, and they say they have killed more than 2,000 Al-Shabaab fighters. Analysts say enlisting religious leaders is another crucial step in attacking Al-Shabaab from various fronts. Abdulaziz Isaac is a security analyst with Hamid bin Khalifa Civilization Center in Denmark, a cultural and research organization. Isaac says religious leaders, just like clan elders in Somalia, are very influential. By bringing them on board in the campaign, the government is taking the right step. He said Al-Shabaab relies on twisting Islamic teachings to drive their ideology, so the clerics can effectively counter that narrative by drawing the line between truth and falsehood. Isaac says even though Al-Shabaab spreads its ideology in mosques and affiliated media, the government may be able to counter those narratives, given the number of clerics on its side. He says Al-Shabaab has its team of clerics too, but they are few, and if all pro-government clerics join forces, they can easily counter them. The government will need to increase funding to the Religious Affairs Ministry and screen the imams to ensure Al-Shabaab does not infiltrate mosques. According to Ahmed Abdi Hadi Abdullahi, the founder of Somali Civic House, a governance think tank in Mogadishu, the conference of clerics and declaration against Al-Shabaab is a major step in challenging the group's use of religion to advance its terrorist agenda. Abdullahi says that for the clerics to come together and make clear that Al-Shabaab's ideology is not based on Islam is a good move and could contribute a lot to the ideological warfare against the group. Abdullahi says the open defiance by the religious leaders is a strong statement considering the targeted assassinations of pro-government clerics by Al-Shabaab.
He
said Al-Shabaab previously killed many clerics and that those clerics who attended the conference come despite that risk. The government and its forces are not now capable of guaranteeing security for those clerics, but for now the assassinations by the group have gradually decreased. Somali government hopes that by enlisting the support of religious leaders, it can further bolster its ongoing war against Al-Shabaab, which has been fighting the government since its emergence in 2007. Last year, Prime Minister Barre picked former Al-Shabaab number 2 Mukhtar Robo for religious affairs minister as part of attempts to deflate Al-Shabaab ideology. As the government campaign enters its 8th month in February, the Somali government is preparing to open new portal fronts in southern parts of the country. Meg Mohammed for VOA News, Mogadishu.
Direct from Washington, the voice of America, VOA.
Tunisians go to the polls Sunday for a second round of parliamentary elections, as activists say the government is cracking down on dissent. The French news agency AFP says 262 candidates, including 34 women, are running for 131 seats. Only 11% of registered voters turned out last month for the first round of voting, which took place last month in a newly reformed legislature with little power to sanction the government of President Kais Saied. A new constitution backed by Saïd last year gives his office almost unlimited executive power. The vote comes as courts have jailed many of his critics. Among them, says Reuters, is Ali Lariadi, the leader of the largest opposition party, Ennahda. He was charged with having helped send jihadists to Syria when his party was in power. A former leader of the entire party, Ghazi Choualchi, is being prosecuted for criticizing the president in a radio interview. An activist, Aichi Hamami, faces trial of spreading fake news online after criticizing Saïd and the justice minister. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Timber boy, timber loot, turn a seven pin. Just some love, it's all I need. Timber boy, you feel me? This will be the chick. Pull up to heaven in a jet. Turn the water to wine. Call that demi suck. Holy water on my neck. For this, I easy like the respect. Turn it for my. As far as I'm concerned, and the lalina is as bad. It's just a little bit of an accent.
Yeah.
say I did it. Big stash, big cash, my way, but still I can't believe. Under 1 minute, still I can't believe. But I can't blame myself for this. New man, them was born for this. Of course, I fucked up. Who never put up hands in the air? No hands. Still I can't believe. You know what I mean? I was young, what you expect from me? It is what it is. But I keep going, no. More like a rolling stone, cause I have no stopping time. Can nobody stop a man? Oh, I keep going, no. More like a rolling stone, cause I have no stopping time. Can nobody stop a man? No, I'm gonna run my race. I'm gonna keep my pace. Cause I really have no one to play. When I fall again, I can't stand this pain. I can't watch me fail. So anytime you pray, remember my name. Remember you know a traveler. The name is Kweku the Hustler. He's been far away, chasing Walala. I'll be back again, for me coming. I swear on my life, I can't wait to be back. I know you miss me, I know. Remember you know a traveler. The name is Kweku the Hustler. He's been far away, chasing Walala. I'll be back again, for me coming. I swear on my life, I can't wait to be back. I know you miss me, I know. When it's on and it's on, you can't stop till it's done. See, goddamn, I'm a buck. Brandy, I'm a sister. It's a great man, oh. That pain for an amateur. It's a great man, oh. It's a great man, oh. When it's on and it's on, I can't stop till it's done. See, goddamn, I'm a buck. Brandy, I'm a sister. It's a great man, oh. That pain for an amateur. It's a great man, oh. It's a great man, oh. See me on the road, talking to you, boys. Remember, you know a traveler. The name is Kweku the Hustler. He's been far away, chasing Walala. I'll be back again, for me coming. I swear on my life, I can't wait to be back. I know you miss me, I know. Remember, you know a traveler. The name is Kweku the Hustler. Far away chasing Walala. I'll be back again for me coming. I swear on my life, I can't wait to be back. I know you miss me, I know.
We don't cast last. Now everybody go to our breakfast.
Shayo.
To discuss, oh, cause I did win by default and without any doubt, oh. I'm a me happy adult, oh. I no go feed the girl, I no go feed the girl, it's out, oh. I'm a mind as you be talk, oh. I put my life into my job and I know I'm in trouble. She manipulate my love, oh. I know holy and I know that kepo, like the Baba Frayo.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Hovey, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the big game often appears when the hunter has given up the hunt for the day. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.